Hello, everybody, and welcome to Lost Explorers. My name is J. David Osborne. That is Chris Saknussemm. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
David, I'm pretty well, thank you. I'm on spring break, which I really needed on multiple levels. It's going very quickly, but I'm getting a lot of creative things done. I did some big batch cooking, a little bit of maintenance after the big winds, but I haven't gotten on to so many things that I want to do. But I'm enjoying the break. I'm hoping that you will enjoy yours next week. I think that they're absolutely vital. And I don't know about your students, but mine were certainly ready. So,
This week to me feels a little bit like a wash. We're
yeah.
going over transition words for paragraphs, a lot of ACT stuff, pretty rudimentary, calling back to things that they would have learned in middle school. And Friday, I have cordoned off as a free reading day where they
Good.
will get a grade just for bringing something physical, not on their phone, to read.
Good.
Free grade.
I think that's, encouraging physical books. It's just so basic a theme, but I am with you 1,000% on the not the evils, but the damage done by the smartphone on that generation in particular. Their level of addiction is disturbing to say the least. So I think that's a lovely idea and a very practical idea.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm ready to hop right into the show. It's
Me
been
too.
a busy week, but we've got a lot of Lost Explorers content to cover because we went off on an amazing tangent last time and a lot of light bulbs went off. But the result of that was that we didn't get to the rest of your amazing notes. So we're going to do that today. Before, though, you have a band and an
I
aphorism for us?
do. I do. I had a brief check back into TikTok because I had been posting some short music videos on that format. I liked the discipline of the very short length pieces. I just wanted to check out that platform and I wanted to be there not as a tourist, but as, kind of a working professional, so to speak. And I again sort of saw this stream of incredibly bizarre young women who some of them do look now completely AI simulated, but even if they're not literally that or CGI rendered or they're so manufactured, it is quite bizarre. And it's very difficult to determine the degree of ironic humor that's surrounding this. I'm not sure in many cases, but so this band is a girls group who are really towing that line with great precision and force. It's entirely impossible to see if they're completely artificial and absolutely sincere in their artificiality, or if it is a kind of big ironic conceptual joke. But I love the name. They are called the Mannequinials. So they're mannequins and millennials. They're picking up on that whole lost demographic. The name of their album is Real Girls Don't Poop.
There we go.
Their lead single, though, is Contaminated Sausage. And for reference, I'm sort of thinking of a really demented, updated version of the Go-Go's from, the 80s and the MTV era, but with a completely manufactured element. Short of this question, are these chicks for real? And hence, the question of real girls don't poop. They're really putting out some very strange TikTok messaging that is just a head spinner.
Did you hear about the bill that passed Congress, the bipartisan bill to ban TikTok?
I did, and I don't know how they're going to do that, though.
It's not. I feel like it's a pretty transparent cash grab on the part of our Congress. They're sending out a message that they need their cut of this if it's
Yeah.
going to exist as it is. And they're currently getting their cut from Meta and what are the other ones? X. They all have different
Alphabet,
names.
which runs Google, you know.
Alphabet, but they're not getting anything from what is the company that owns TikTok again? Do you remember off the top of your head?
No, I don't. I don't.
Anyhow, that Chinese company is clearly not paying anything except probably to the Apple store. And that just won't do. That just won't do.
Well, you know, I don't understand any of the machinations behind the scenes in financial terms. It does resonate with a book that I did some brief editing on, but I thought it was in such good shape. It really, its problem wasn't editing. Its problem was the faith of editors in putting it forward, because its argument is that the line between organized crime and legitimate business is completely imaginary and has been for some time. Where it veers into really problematic areas is it would extend that argument to say that Silicon Valley and its ilk, high tech, have not just facilitated this blurring of boundaries. They are, in fact, that's the reason for them being. In other words. So I think that it goes from a very, very provocative idea that's nonetheless very downbeat and sobering, to a one that's a little bit conspiratorial, that is more than the head can bear. It's good novel territory if anyone would that kind of novel anymore, but of course they won't. So
And of course, you know, people would say, well, the mafia, though, engages in criminal activity. They take out hits. I would stop whoever this hypothetical person was right there and say, have you done any digging into the amount of whistleblowers who end up with self-inflicted shotgun wounds from, 10 feet?
well, the Boeing guy just died. I don't know
The
the
that was what was that was what was on my mind. The Boeing guy, the gentleman who discovered that when Boeing is on a tight schedule, allegedly, and they need to finish a plane, they'll go to a scrap yard and just find whatever pieces they
Whatever it
can make
takes,
work.
whatever it takes.
He ended up with was he a two gunshots to the head guy or was he a shotgun guy?
I can't remember now. I think
Or was he
gunshot.
a fall off a balcony guy? That's a popular one too.
Yeah, all of those are so, you know, completely. I mean, and what's funny is we see this fodder, you know, as the basis of so much entertainment. And then it surprises us that this would be happening in real life, supposedly. I mean, I don't get that. I mean, of course.
Doesn't surprise me
No,
at
there are a
all.
lot of but I'll tell you another interesting I haven't I just heard about it, and it hasn't crossed my desk, and I don't know if it will, but it's another book that is actually, this one is really under contract, but its argument is that it's written by a psychologist, and his point, I think, actually, it's a man and a woman team. It seems to be the argument that all of our thoughts on mental illness are completely, if not an error, they're missing something absolutely essential, because we're not factoring in organized crime, the mentality of that. All our thinking about, you know, sociopathy or, you know, psychopathologies of various kinds, they kind of exclude a really important group of people. We have very little information, really, and very little reason to believe, you know, in the veracity of anything we do have. Because why would those people tell, you know, really? It's weird. They very well might, and they might not really understand themselves either. So we've got massive, very powerful demographic at work in the world, arguably the most powerful, and we really don't have any understanding of their mindset and how their networks hold together. It can't all be fear, you know. It just that doesn't that just can't
Well, no, I mean
be.
the self-interest also. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
self-interest, I think that there is a gamification of crime for sure. There is the urge to level up and achieve in ways that aren't necessarily financial. It's monkeys with bones, man. You
Yeah,
know?
I think there's so it's a parallel universe with its own anthropology, and I think that we have whatever we do have is always interested writers, not just crime writers, but I think every writer, because it's so filled with drama and interesting networks and relationships and possibilities. But I think we really just know nothing, and as the experts would say, we might be better off for that ignorance, you know? So that's that. And
Yeah. Do you have an aphorism for us today?
I do, and I have, well, I actually have two. I have one real one, and then I have a funny story about the second one. The real one is, every question is a trick question. Tricks are good. And I think we need to remember that the idea of what a trick question is like, well, duh, you know, get a little bit excited and curious about the world, but also remember that we enjoy tricks. We're kind of bored when we don't, when there are no people with tricks, interesting angles. But here's the second one, which I think is really funny. I went through a phase where I was leaving little messages all around my house for myself, you know, that positive thinking sort of message. And for whatever reason, I just photocopied this one phrase, cut it out, and put it everywhere. And I eventually, I couldn't face it, so I put them away. But I came upon the box, I saved the whole box of them. And as I was moving it out of the closet in the hallway, I just spilled out all of the little cuttings. And they all said, the best books write themselves. And I just started laughing. I thought, wow, okay, that was a little glimpse back into a mindset at one point. But it
Yeah.
ended up being so cool, just spread out, you know, naturally, so to speak, in the hallway. So those are
Yeah.
the two.
That is really interesting too. And it's also the form or the shape of its ultimate space within your life is sort of proof of its own concept.
Exactly. Thank you. I
Yeah.
knew you'd appreciate that. It's Osbornean and Borgesian all at once. Yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. So, for the son,
That's one of our Spidey.
can you take that in the room, please? He's putting his toys into a pot.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a good move.
Yeah. Are you gonna eat those?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's got
Yeah.
long hair. Wow.
Yeah, he's got a
He's a hippie.
we might cut it when he's three, but he might not want to at this point. That was the plan, to let it grow until he was three. So last time, like I mentioned at the top of the show, we were really hot on an idea.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Imaginative challenge.
We do have an imaginative challenge. Here we go.
Yeah. This is an interesting one too. This requires you to wear three sort of different hats. Okay, I want you to think of a pre-1960s model novel story, okay? Pre-1960s America. I want you to draw on this model to kind of recreate the story in outline for our time today. Okay. So you're riffing on a classic American novel plot line. But I want you to create something that couldn't or wouldn't be published today, and then to be able to critically explain why. So it's sort of synthetic, speculative, and analytical. Three different hats.
By the model novel Talking about actual models, fashion models.
No, like a story, like whether it be well, you I mean you taught The Great Gatsby. I mean, I think that's a skeletal model structure, a plot line. I think you could, I mean, there's just so many different ones to go with. But something that you th that that is has a clear sort of plot line, I suppose. But that just wouldn't get looked at today, and why?
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that helps.
I
Okie
can throw
dokie.
in one other example, but I don't want to really tinge your thinking too much. Do you want one other example that?
Sure, yeah, that's fine.
All right, well, I mean, The Great Gatsby is a very, very simple plot, and it really hinges on the mistake in the car sort of story. But I think we know the larger picture there. Another storyline that comes to mind is Deliverance.
Oh, okay.
Very,
Yep.
very different. So I'll give you those two very radically different storylines as examples of work that in plot synopsis form were seen as very interesting in their time and ultimately became very successful novels, certainly The Great Gatsby. But I think, I mean, Deliverance was huge in its day.
Yeah,
And
those
both
are.
became interesting film treatments, I think. Gatsby several times.
Right.
The movie of Deliverance, I think, still remains one of the great achievements.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That is very interesting. We'll see what I come up with.
Okay. I don't want to say any more because I think I might, start doing it for you then.
Sure. Yeah, no, we don't want to do that. Okay. So we were hot on something last time. Why did I open Microsoft Word? That's not what I'm looking for. Here we go. We talked about real and the unreal. We talked about representation versus reality. Now, where the conversation goes, you paraphrase some of this, but I'm going to reread it for the listener. So this representation versus reality, representation as reality. It's interesting to me to note how far we have degenerated from Schopenhauer's ideas put forth in The World as Representation and Will. I think all forms of German idealism have a lot to answer for in Western thinking, but Schopenhauer had a lot more on his mind than we do today. Case in point, Google's Gemini AI image generator has recently caused a stir for ludicrous depictions of black popes, black female popes, Black Vikings, although they look kind of cool, 100% agree, and images of the founding fathers as blacks and Native Americans, which rather contradicts the revisionist history program of today. The right scorns the images as overzealous wokeness or outright historical misrepresentation. The left dodges and weaves and claims this is how stereotypes get broken down. The larger and deeper problem, however, is the notion that image alone is what counts. This isn't what Schopenhauer meant as representation. He meant a magical human capability of imagining all of existence. It was human-centric, to be sure, but it was deep conceptually and structurally. Now, what we mean is optics, pure visual surface. We mean the artificial world of media and entertainment. Yet we know people aren't really fooled by this, just frustrated. American black people know that one black president and a few millionaires and even billionaire celebrities don't equate to genuine structural change. How can this discordance not cause confusion and anger? So I think that's a pretty good summary of what we talked about last time. I wasn't directly reading it, but we touched on a lot of these points.
Yes, okay.
Now, to return to the UFO mythos, which was at the top of the note last episode. Although the media and commercial entertainments may promote and facilitate the mythos, they haven't created it. I think it comes from a much deeper psychic space within culture. Its representation in Schopenhauer's sense, the fact that it doesn't align with any one socio-political agenda is evidence of this. The Gemini images are pure agenda. They have no mythic substance. As problematic as wokeness is, it's not the cause of the problems we face. Rather, wokeness has been able to rise because of a much broader trend of superficial thinking. Schopenhauer meant representation as a dynamic, imaginative process, a verb form. We've turned it into a flimsy noun form and now mistake it for reality. Stendhal said that a novel was a mirror walking along a road. That meant something in the 19th century. Now the world is only mirrors, and people think that painting the mirrors changes the world. Mythos remains and remains more elusive. If the UFO mythos means anything, it's an attempt to look beyond the mirrors. What's out there, really? This is some great as above, so below type thinking. What we're really looking for when we're looking out into the stars to see if there are extraterrestrial life forms visiting us in tic-tac shaped spaceships is in fact an innate desire to escape from this kind of false optic representation that we're inundated with on a daily basis, rather than, I think the most basic way of putting it is representation as mirror. It has to include the good, the bad, and the ugly of everybody. And in doing so, create a three-dimensional image of reality rather than this flattened, two-dimensional, anti-mythos reality.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that the longer we go, I mean, I don't know. I can remember when we first started talking about the enormous importance of photography, the innovation of photography and its implications, and putting that in the same frame, or even a much more dimensionalized one, from the printing press and Marshall McLuhan's idea of the Gutenberg galaxy, in terms of what print did to standardize language, to standardize thinking. And I think this is the very, very one of many, many peculiar things about photography morphing into media world, a secondary reality, the matrix that we really all work with. I mean, the fact now that so many people can recognize facially far more famous people, celebrities, reality TV stars, they're much more fluent than they are with their own neighbors. I mean, that is a startling tribute to the delusional nature of society today and how completely hypnotized we are by the whole process. And one crucial aspect, one of, I think, I don't know, I'm trying to inventory them, but there are about 100 so far. But one I think that's really amazingly important and goes unnoticed, you and I have touched on this, but I don't see it happening in broader cultural studies terms. The notion of individual time, you know, we just went through daylight savings. But I think that the media world, and now through streaming, has allowed people to access shows, entertainment, information when they want to. There's no ceremonial meeting ground of watching the Ed Sullivan show together, because we don't have, if we miss it, we miss it, you know? And we talked about that, I don't know, many, many episodes ago, but, you know, not being in the room when it happens, being able to press the pause button, but being able to also to binge, you know, to think in a completely strange way relative to how TV shows and movies, you know, were consumed not that long ago,
right?
You know, really not that long ago. So we've created not only a secondary world of immense seductive power, but also we've completely revised the notion of time. And I think that we have no firm hold anymore on communal, social, and cultural time. I think those are fragmenting. I mean, God, I remember when people used to worry about night shift people. And I was on the night shift. It took me about a year and a half to get off it. But That's structural and physical. This is now completely bizarre, where people are not keeping any kind of time relative, and part of the goal is to not keep time, not to be part of the rat race, not to be on the 9 to 5, being able to sleep in, all of these weird things of breaking free of communality. And faced with that psychopathology, I think that the UFO mythology is inevitable as some sort of dim, pretty vaguely formed, but nonetheless religious hope in an age of anti-religion,
I would agree with that 100%. It's interesting what you said about the television show because people used to have to remember what happened on a television show the last time they watched it. Not necessarily in terms of, the Twilight Zone or sitcoms, for example, which is why those formats were invented in the first place, to make it so
Correct.
you don't have to remember what happened last week on Seinfeld because it's a totally new thing. But we did have serialized shows and they did have recaps, and you did have to sort of do your best to recall those. Although what's really interesting to me is that I come back to this a lot on the show, the different Greek conceptions of time, and I believe it's Kairos, which is the idea that every Thursday is the same Thursday. So there's deep time, there is the time of the current now living, and there is situational time. So every time you get into the car is car time. It's almost aboriginal in a way, if you think of it like
Yes, yes.
and so I'm thinking in terms of whatever we want to call that particular time. We'll call it car time just for Lost Explorer shorthand. In terms of television shows, every time you sat down to watch MASH or Miami Vice or something like that, it was Miami Vice time. And it was separated by another form of time, but you were able to kind of experience that, every Miami Vice time is the same Miami Vice time. Binging contracts that so that it's very similar to the type of time that we're supposed to experience on a day-to-day basis. And I wonder if that doesn't contribute to a kind of loss of ritual, because sitting down to watch a TV time is ritual time.
Absolutely. Ritual time is what I would the phrase I would use. That anthropologically, that is exactly what's going on. And that links indigenous peoples around the world with some of Philip K. Dick's funnier stories. It's a realization that I think is structurally very, very sound as opposed to real, I'll say. And it's a vital part of the history of those entertainments having a deeper level of meaning in culture. And I think for older people, I mean, my mother's a good example. I mean, she has watched every episode of MASH, I don't know
Yeah.
how many times. It
Yeah.
isn't about, it isn't even about dealing with loneliness. Of course, that is there. That was one of my very early contentions about the origins of mass media, that it was really about loneliness. And I mentioned then, and I'll mention it again now, a very famous Australian story by Henry Lawson called The Drover's Wife. Very, very simple, basic. It's almost painfully stark and bare. About a woman alone, the drover, so she's the wife, the drover's wife of the story. He's off moving cattle around, and she's out in the middle of the huge Neverland of Australia, nowhere, which is really enough to swallow anybody up. But I mean, living in Oklahoma, you get that. I live in Nevada. I mean, we all have some reference of that. But the A snake gets under their very rough, humble cabin. That's really kind of, it's just this woman alone dealing with the kids. But the loneliness, the absolute loneliness, and you can hear in that the need for like a radio playing or a TV set, soap opera, something to keep, women company. And the loneliness factor is certainly there. But I think that ritualization, and to be fair to a genre that I think is often really looked down on is the soap opera. And they do beautifully about building time and really giving, I mean, it's amazing evolution, to see the great way in General Hospital or,
Days of
as
our lives, yeah.
yeah, those kinds of things that exist, they really are, Philip K.
Almost 80 years, almost 80 years, Days of Our Lives been going on. The Young and the Restless, these are getting close. In our lifetimes, these shows will become 100-year-old television shows.
It's a remarkable achievement. And I think that the same formula or success rate, if you want to think of it that way, is followed in other places, South America, Europe. I think some of the Asian countries have similar success stories. So it's a really interesting format. But there, it's entirely about the ritual time. And I think that umbrella embraces everything else that we've been talking about in terms of dealing with loneliness, structuring reality, structuring the management of time, and linking an individual with something bigger, whether it's not really society in that sense, it's because it's media world stuff, but it's a secondary world beyond someone's, their four walls or eight walls or 12 walls, whatever they have. But ritual is really important. And we've kind of de-ritualized everything with the binging, streaming. I don't know. It seems a real strange fragmentation.
Would you say that it's possible to binge a novel?
Yes, I
Do you
have a
think
few.
that's And I agree with you. And the reason why that I think it's important to make that distinction is because mind states and time states are persons. See what I mean? Like a time state has a kind of personhood. And binging, if you think of binging as a house, it depends on what you want to fill that house with. Because time states are houses and houses are persons. And so we are basically, when we're binging, we are in the house of the binge. And Netflix, I think, is what really did damage to the novel. It was already in decline. I'm not going to pretend that when I was in high school, everybody was reading voraciously, but people did read. There was that kind of binge state where people would sit down and read a book. But that kind of inhabitation of a certain type of time, I think, has been taken up by Netflix shows. I really do think that giving everybody everything all at once like that has not just been bad for the storytelling, because now we have, instead, Arthur Conan Doyle invented this with Sherlock Holmes. He invented the overarching net meta narrative that was made up of individual self-contained mysteries, where, as the series went on, the conflict between Holmes and Moriarty got more and more intense, but it was never the main focus of any individual mystery up until later on. And so I think that shows like The X-Files do that really well still, back when it was, weekly television. But now with the binge, we have 8-hour movies, which aren't as great. 8-hour movies are not as good because they're not as in because they don't have to be as interesting. They don't have to keep your attention week to week anymore. They can just keep your attention. If they can hook you in for 8 hours, then hey, it's good. They got you. You stayed on the platform for 8 hours.
And you're completely, really passive for those. I mean, I think that one of the problems of comparing a novel to anything in the television framework is that, I mean, the units of a novel have not for a long time been coherent and agreed upon in the sense of a chapter of certain, a certain length. I mean, one of my favorite chapters in all of literature is from As I Lay Dying. And it's one, it's My Mother is a Fish. Great. I mean, Faulkner, man, at shoveling coal into the night at the Oxford University power or Ole Miss power plant. So the idea of the novel being, I mean, only certain very commercial novels are really, really chapter driven, with the chapters being just absolutely equal in length. Whereas we've accepted that standardized format within the television framework. I mean, it's either, if it's an hour, it was 46 minutes with commercials. Or it's under 30 minutes, 26 minutes, whatever. And so those units kind of, we never really broke out of them. And the nearest I can see is kind of the it's like what FM radio did to AM radio with the short run series, like six episodes. I quite like those, and I think that the only, if they're working well, they are, I think, an incitement to try to see the whole arc. So I can see kind of binging in that sort of way. I guess the thing with binging is, do you do that across everything? I have students who that's their approach to everything. Their only,
Binging.
their only approach. It's binge or flick, swipe right or whatever, keep.
I want to go back really quickly. You're switching representation from a verb form to a noun form. A lot of times when I read these notes that Chris sends me, I worry that listeners might miss the kind of clever ways that he demonstrates his concepts. So if we go with Schopenhauer meant representation as a dynamic imaginative process, a verb form, we've turned it into a flimsy noun form and mistake it for reality. Okay, now pay attention to this next sentence. Stendhal said that a novel was a mirror walking along a road. That's a verb. That's a mirror in motion. That meant something in the 19th century. This is Chris again. Now the world is only mirrors, static mirrors, mirrors standing still, but we're putting different coats of paints on those mirrors. And I have to say, what a better visualization of where we're at than those two lines. I think that's great.
Thank you. I'm glad they communicate. I think that is really where we're at. I think it's, I don't think it's any more complicated than that, but that's not to say it's not very disorienting, because words in abundance are,
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think that will wrap that up. I did want to get to the next one because Chris has some bangers for us. Shifting gears just a bit. Temporary tattoos and the latest Oscar night. Two more examples of why we've entered the post-civilization age. People who say the Oscars have been in decline for quite a while are the kind of folks who wouldn't draw much distinction between Ted Bundy returning to have sex with a corpse 3 days after the murder or 3 weeks. I maintain there's a difference.
I thought you might.
A good necrophilia joke's gonna get me every time. Moving along, it's struck me of late that there's a relationship between education, public school system, and tourism, which often goes unnoticed. We know there's a connection between education and travel. Travel is how humanity has educated itself about the human globe and all this means, the planet Earth, and the larger world universe we've been able to comprehend. All good. Tourism? Not so good. Why? What is the difference between travel and tourism? Let's stop right there. Chris, what is the difference between travel and tourism?
Okay, I think it's a really, really important distinction on multiple levels. Psychologically and sociologically, I think we can say that travel is a more sophisticated, subtler, deeper, more engaged form of experience of other cultures and other environments. Tourism is seen to be, in a sense, lower class, prepackaged, prearranged, more an assembly line or conveyor belt experience for more people. It's predicated on the idea that whatever the object or the destination, let's say, is, somehow that destination remains intact and equally accessible, no matter how many people arrive, and whatever expectations they bring, whatever frameworks they bring. But tourism is something that is certainly fully intentional, I think, commercialized with a very low barrier of prerequisite knowledge. I think that it's kind of I mean, obviously there are degrees of it financially, so luxury isn't quite the right word in a sense, but it is an indulgence. It's a recreational indulgence as opposed to an accidental experience, a necessary experience. We see a lot of people, there are something like 60 to 100 million people in the world in transit right now as refugees and asylum seekers. There are professional travelers of various kinds. There's military and scientific. There's always a sense of purpose that is, I think, cultural in some way, whereas the purpose in tourism is individual.
I would agree with that for sure. Travel is much more of you interacting with the world. And when I do think of tour, because whenever I've traveled in the past with Rios, I've always been very hesitant to go full tourist.
Yes.
I'm more instead of when we go to London, for example, we do the London thing. You go to London Bridge, all the kind of tourist destinations that you could think of. But I was also waking up at 5:30 in the morning to just wander, looking for an outdoor gym that I could exercise on, which brought me to a very foggy, spooky apartment complex with some playground equipment that I could do push-ups and pull-ups on. And I think that element of danger can't be taken out of travel as well. So it's this interactive element, the fact that you are actively becoming a part of a kind of stream rather than someone in a plastic bubble, a hamster ball that's sort of moving along, and the danger element as well.
Yeah, or risk. The risk of surprise,
Risk.
I think,
Yeah, no.
and surprise is such a huge category, but I think that is absolutely essential. Whereas that would be contraindicated in a tourism sort of capability and capacity. But the other thing is, like for people like you and me, I think we resist the notion of being tourists. We would like to think we're kind of above that. And yet, I think that oddly enough, we could have some fun doing a very touristy thing and sort of letting our guard down about that. Because for us, it would be something different. It wouldn't be the norm. But there's a really, really interesting tension between these two notions. And I think we can use that tension, that kind of taffy pull between travel and tourism, what those mean, and why the distinction, why the psychological tonal values that are so different, which is what I think is really, really important. I think we can use that as a means of looking at what's happened to public education, because there are some resonances. I mean, in the notes, I mentioned that I think that whatever we mean by tourism is something that is a relatively recent phenomenon. I think that it really dates to after World War II. I think before then, travel is the term, and I think it involves an entirely different, very complex class, not a unified class of people, but a very, very special, eccentric club. Working across social classes, but it wasn't an organized tourism thing as say Hawaii and Mexico became in the 1950s for America. Las Vegas, there's a whole world and a whole series of mechanics or mechanisms that we just naturally assume go along with tourism. And that's a pretty recent event. And I would say that that corresponds to the point in American history where the public school network is a national entity, a national dream anyway, comes into being. I don't, before then, I mean, there was an awful lot of kids who didn't go anywhere near a school during the Depression years. I think we're very fragmented around America. I think America was very extremely regionalized. And there would have been people, if they did go to school, there were still one room schoolhouses. So everything that we think of as, the modern school, as a national phenomenon, I think begins about the same time that we see what we call the tourism industry begin to really take off, which is mid-20th century America.
I'm interested in the connection between these two things. I 100% see the correlation there, and I understand metaphorically, there is the connection between education being a program, a very regimented program with very little room, wiggle room, as is tourism. When you're a tourist somewhere, you are on a tight schedule. You got to be here, you got to be here, you got to be here. There's also the sanitization, either of knowledge or of the places that you're going. There's also, and I think you can take this in two different ways, there's the implicit, especially for Americans, the implicit understanding that you don't have to learn the language wherever you go. And I think you could say that about education as well. You can learn the concepts, history, the rules, etc., but you don't have to learn the language. You can learn about the Revolutionary War, for example, but you don't have to take the extra step to attempt to perhaps read diaries from around that time to kind of put yourself in that time to learn the language of that time. And I was wondering what, in addition to those things, maybe perhaps what you see as the bigger shift that allowed those two industries, education and tourism, to rise concurrently.
Well, first of all, I think that many people would be surprised to hear that connection. I think that it might
I
seem
think so too. Yeah.
fairly straightforward to us, but I think there are a lot of people who really would be somewhat taken aback and would need
Dubious, yeah.
more convincing and more connecting. I think there are a lot of people who have been historically involved in education that would be really disheartened by that connection, because I think there was a lot of belief in the value of public education to the point where I don't think anyone really questioned what education was. I think they had an assumption that any kind of formal instruction, any kind of disciplined approach to information, socialization, etiquette, and notice suddenly we start to smear those, don't we? No one would even think twice about that going into the same sentence of, learning and knowledge, etiquette, proper decorum, all those things start to smush. But the idea was to, the American dream was to lift people up and to lift them up oftentimes in kind of artificial class ways rather than skill and knowledge ways.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Yeah, that's the Steinbeck stuff. That's the Steinbeck quote. The problem with Americans is that they all believe that they're temporarily embarrassed millionaires. So you lift someone up class-wise, which we've seen now. We have many of the same amenities at base level as millionaires, but that's it. That's all they've really done.
It gets down to basic utilities, doesn't it? I mean, if you think of it, we've just got pretty, significant communications and plumbing networks. It really,
The
and
entirety of Western
plumbing precedes
civilization.
that.
Yeah, the entirety of Western civilization is just improved communication and plumbing networks. I co-sign that entirely. I like that.
It does make a lot of sense when you look to, modernizing African nations. I mean, that's one of the ways that the government controls things in, say, both Nigeria and South Africa. They just shut off the water, But meanwhile, there's a significant population that doesn't have access to water and electricity officially. They're stealing it. It's just that in the shanty towns, everyone just turns away the townships and goes, well, that's just how that's done. But there's no thought about, well, maybe we should extend the central, plumbing, and let's wire everything. No. But we certainly take that entirely for granted here and put on a lot of airs about what we're really doing. And I think that the idea with the education versus travel and education versus tourism models is, in the travel sense, education really was elitist. Academic liberal arts education was elitist. We were at a point in both the UK and the United States educating between, well, some estimates were as low as 2%. That seems a little harsh, but let's say between 6 and 20% of the population. And obviously, there is a very significant gender gap on that, no question. And the racial issues don't need to be said. Suddenly, we take that model of what education is. Let's say that's the travel destination in this metaphorical analysis. We suddenly say we're going to get 60% of people going to that destination, going to education in a travel sense, from 6% to 60%. And we're also then throwing in an immense amount of diversity within that new giant group of people. Gender difference, racial differences, language differences, behavioral differences, learning disability or capability differences, physical disability capability differences. We've suddenly said, wow, we're just going to blow that open. And really, after beginning in the 1960s, virtually every year, there has been some move on the part of the education system to increase diversity of access, to increase the strain on teachers, physical schools, to be more inclusive, to tailor this program on ever more individual bases,
IEPs,
and to conduct more and more one-on-one in ever more crowded class situations. I mean, it's ludicrous. I look at my two classes and I think, wait a minute, we can't get any more people in these rooms physically. And yet I can come back after, coming home, and I can find individual emails from all of them. It's just like, no, it's the worst of every possible system. So I think that what we've tried to do with public education, and this is why private education has become even more elitist, expensive, and selective, it's more like luxury travel. Going off on one of those yachts with a trained biologist to get your personal tour of the Galapagos Islands, and public education would be a tour bus in midsummer in Yosemite or Yellowstone National Park.
And you get there on a flight from Spirit Airlines.
And anyone who I ask this question to people, I say, what does Yosemite or Yellowstone National Park smell like at mid-morning, a couple of days after the 4th of July? And there is a correct answer. And it's unfortunately overflowing toilets. You know, it isn't lush pine. It isn't dry, you know, about to go up in flames, forest fire nature. It's not alpine air. And it's not even bus fumes. It really, what comes to my mind is just that absolutely unmistakable overflowing central toilet block smell.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to leave this one. We'll come back to this conversation next time. So my novel, I went ahead and went with The Great Gatsby
Okay.
as a model. And I'm also using character names here, but obviously in my version of this, they would be changed in some way. But just for the sake of people kind of who are familiar with the novel,
No, I think
kind of
that's a good
understand.
idea. I think that's a good idea.
I like this idea of a retelling of Gatsby in 2024 because we have a young Nick Carraway heading out to California this time
Okay, that makes sense.
for to work for a startup instead of on Wall Street now. Now we have the startups working for a vending machine company that is reinventing the soda machine by shooting jets of soda directly into people's mouths. Nick is someone who is a true believer, so kind of a libtard in the common parlance. Someone who's both obsessed with the idea of money, but also clinging to a kind of wokeness that is born of being what he believes to be a good person. He, of course, comes upon Gatsby, who is reaching out from the top of his penthouse toward a green energy billboard. I thought that was fun. He's trying to get back with Daisy, who is married into a reality television family. Gatsby is a Bitcoin millionaire,
Okay.
and he lives in West Ovum. No more West Egg. It's West Ovum. He's throwing ever more elaborate cuddle parties where the rich drink reishi smoothies and talk about their trauma, and importantly, cuddle with each other. We'd be able to show how the rich have changed in the 100 years since the Roaring Twenties. And of course, wherever there is Bitcoin, there is money laundering and all the Meyer Wolfschheims that go along with it. So Gatsby didn't get there with clean hands. He's still dirty. Now here's where we get to the central plot here. Nick's college roommate, Tom, is the one with Daisy. Tom is part of this reality TV show family, so he is completely glued to his phone at all times. He's a huge TikTok star. But this is where the real twist has happened. Daisy and Tom have been in this world of the rich 2024 elites for so long that Tom has transitioned into a woman and Daisy has transitioned into a man.
Oh,
So
wow.
they're still, as they make sure everybody understands every chance they get, they are still a straight couple. This adds an extra layer to Gatsby's longing. You get the whole idea that he wants to be a part of this world, a self-made man, which is still a part of I think our world today in its own way, whatever that might mean today. But the queering of the narrative begins to make him question what made him fall in love with Daisy in the first place. Is he in love with Tom? Is he in love with Daisy? Is he in love with Nick? That would be my, and the reasons why, critically, why this would not be published today is that I would want to really skewer liberalism at all of its levels, not just focusing on the silly woke stuff, but on like drawing a parallel between the hollowness of Gatsby's fortune that he made bootlegging and the fortunes that a lot of these guys make by, you know, buying GameStop stock, I think is really apropos. And you know, Gatsby is at its best when it is showing that no matter how hard you try, you will never, the working class brain is wired just a little bit differently than those of the super rich. And so Gatsby's utter confusion, gender confusion, sexual attraction confusion, I think would play into where, you know, people would just keep telling him, like, you just don't get it, man. You just don't understand. And his mystification, I think, would really rub all the people who this is skewering in the wrong way.
Wow, I think that's a really, really cogent analysis because, I mean, as you were laying it out, I thought this is just so fantastically on the money and really in just amazing harmony with today. But I think, yeah, you've straightened me out on that. And that's why, I'm at such a distance with what's going on because to me, this does seem really just beautifully. On point, and I kept seeing that in a movie sense. I actually saw not a definite character, but I could really see somehow a cameo for Bret Easton Ellis,
Oh yeah, he'd have to be in it.
I think he would actually really dig that. I think
Yeah.
and you could almost get him to kind of find his own way. He just He would just fit in perfectly. But the Bitcoin versus bootlegging thing, I think, is absolutely spot on. I think that's gorgeous.
What's the name of the piano player in Gatsby, the one who leaves his shoes, who comes back for his shoes at the end? Do you remember that character's name?
The guy living in the
Yeah, who's like a he's like a descendant of Beethoven or something. That could be Brett's character.
Yeah, something like that. That's a magical sort of a character, I think. And I liked the green energy as, I think was that kind of the alternative to Dr. T.J. Eckelberg, that that
No, well, remember he's reaching out towards the green light across the bay
I see. Okay,
toward
so
Daisy's house.
that's what that, that's I thought that was more.
Oh, I do need an Eckelberg though.
Yeah.
What could the
Yeah.
Eckelberg be for this? I'd have to think about that. But yeah, you can't have Gatsby without the iconic eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg.
Something, I mean, living in Vegas, I'm thinking of a plastic surgery billboard.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's room for some interesting AI development. But I think you're probably right in your analysis of why that would get dumped. And I think what's interesting is what a trivial reason, because it is such a good story and it's a really good. As you've laid it down, it's a nice mashup to the point of being really much more an evolution. It isn't a mashup of anything. It's just kind of a really nice updating of that. But I think you're right, probably. And also, I one reason why I think, honestly, this is really tragic, why this might get refused in a publishing context as opposed to a film Hollywood context. I think there are a fair number of young editing type people who really wouldn't necessarily, without explanation, unless you pitched it straight out to them, they wouldn't recognize if you did change the character names. I don't know if they would get that on their own. I think they would need that in a tagline, a slug line, your pitch letter of, this is a new take on the Great Gatsby
Has
mythology.
anybody done that? Has anybody tried to update The Great Gatsby for 2024?
I don't know. I mean, I it's a good
This might be
question.
a good idea. This might be, there might be some juice here.
Well, that's why I wanted to throw that out to you because you engage with these ideas, these challenges so effectively that there really is no telling what could develop. And I think you've got some really I like it. I like it as an idea. I think that there are so many things that are consistent. I think even coming out of the roaring, whole sense of the Roaring Twenties, the prohibition conflict, I think that's a schism that we have a lot of references to now. I like that. I thought that was it'd be interesting to see what your title would be for that, But
Yeah,
it's
it would
thinking
have to
about it a
come
little bit
out.
more.
Yeah, it would have to come out in the telling of it. Hold on, it's gonna bother me until I find out what this guy's name with the shoes. Guy with
The piano player.
the shoes, Gatsby. Because he's got him on retainer to play an organ in his living room.
Oh, it's the Oregon Trail.
Oregon. Sorry, I have to do
No,
this.
this is important. This is magical. This might be the name of the book. You might just be able to pull that out, you know? Nice.
Oh yeah. Do 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 do. Let's look at the cast of the movie since Google's not helping me, right? Google has become really worthless, hasn't it, recently? I mean,
They're in
it's,
trouble. There's
yeah.
trouble in the empire. You can really, really feel it on multiple levels.
Oh no, you know who Ellis would be? He'd be Owl Eyes in the library. Yeah. He'd be Owl Eyes. Shoot. I don't know. I'm not seeing it. While I look, do you have a tool and a tip for us today? I can run on two tracks.
I do.
Yeah.
Okay. I had a strange sense of deja vu about the tool, and I thought maybe this had come up before, but I'm not so sure. But I thought in any case, the first part of the tool is, I think, be very, very alert, as we always say, to deja vu experiences, to the coincidence, synchronicity, you know, those little glitches. To really journal those, if you can, even just a voice memo, to quickly grasp and kind of record that, because it's they're mysterious and precious, and they really are. They're clues to our internal associative patterns, if they're not clues to the larger mosaic mystery world. But the house across the street from me is in kind of a weird limbo. I bought it that the neighbor before died in the place. She was older, and it has a gorgeous view of the lake, but it needed a lot of work. And this guy showed up. He's got a really big truck. He's got a beautiful Airstream. He's got perfect teeth. He must have some money, but he's a little odd because he mentioned his wife being in some RV park in Palm Springs. Well, this was months ago, never a sight of her. He's come up a few times to do work on the place. He has a for rent sign out, which is no one's going to take him up on that. It's very odd. But this is one of the few houses that has its own swimming pool. It's pretty small, but it has this beautiful view overlooking the lake. But in the night, if I'm out for a walk or if I'm just sort of meditating in the dark on my porch, I'll often hear this whoosh sound of like a bird landing in the pool. Well, first of all, in the dark, that's quite a significant effort because the pool is not big. And then I was thinking, look, ducks, which is most likely what it is. Ducks are not solitary birds. They're really not. They really like to be in a flock. They like to be together. So I thought this is very, very odd. Now I was trying to think of my knowledge of the local bird. It was some beautiful, you know, they're amazing birds, including a California condor I mentioned at one point. I haven't seen that bird again, but I don't ever hope to. That was magical. But there just aren't that many birds that are out flying around alone at night in this environment. And most birds don't fly around alone at night, period. Ravens don't, you know, and they're solitary. So I heard this in the dead silence the other night, and I thought, you know, I have a deep spiritual obligation to go explore. There's nobody home. I'm going to go in the gate. I'm going to check this out. And I thought, well, I will take my flashlight, but I'm just going to sneak up on it because I don't. So I go across and I'm very quiet. And I'm pretty good at being quiet. The Solomon Islands taught me that. And I haven't forgotten. And I eased in the gate, And everything is just absolutely dead silence. Maybe there's an airplane coming over the mountains, just turning. But it's pretty quiet down below from a traffic point of view. It's about 3 or 4 in the morning. And I was ready with my flashlight to hit the water. And I did. And there was nothing there. And I thought, wow, that is very, very odd because I heard this big sound. I did not hear any other sounds like a bird taking off. There was nothing sunk in the pool. I mean, it was just a full-blown mystery in its own way. So I turned off my light and I headed back, and there's enough sort of distant light over Vegas to illuminate the mountains. And I walked back to my house and I thought, curiosity is its own reward. I absolutely did not feel frustrated by this. I didn't feel disappointed. I felt in this very precious state of being able to savor the mystery and almost kind of glad that there hadn't been an obvious answer of like a mallard duck, you know? That's kind of what I was expecting. But I really don't know what was going on there. But it resonates with a lot of the material in my memory and alertness book because I contrast the idea of what you listen to at night. Say you're alone camping, or say you're alone as I've been in living in very remote situations. When we moved onto the land, my then wife couldn't sleep for a couple of weeks because she just wasn't used to that kind of quiet. And it wasn't quiet. There were roos fighting it out. There was a wombat stumbling around, a blind wom. There was all these sounds that meant something. And we get disconnected from the auditory and always are focusing on the visual. So I learned something from that. But I think the tool is really savor and celebrate your curiosity. And don't have expectations about what's going to be fulfilled from that. Curiosity is its own reward and it's energizing. It really gets into your chest, as Miles Davis said about good music.
Beautiful. I love that. By the way, the character's name was Clipspringer.
Oh, that's a great name. Just that's the novel's name. Just hold on to that. That's a beautiful.
Clipspringer.
Well done. See?
And you know how Gatsby was killed in his pool?
Yes.
This version of Gatsby is killed while he's in VR swimming in a pool. He's got
Oh.
his VR headset on. And
Oh, I love that.
Wilson is no longer Myrtle's husband. Wilson is Myrtle's father because Myrtle is very underage and Tom is elite, and you know how they do. So a little bit darker, but.
Oh, I love all of those changes. Clipspringer is a great, great name for it. And I think those, yes, I love the VR imagery was beautiful. That's lovely.
This is the first time I've ever completed my imaginative challenge after the tool, but first time for everything, I suppose. But worth it, I hope.
I think that's really, really good. And the tip this time is it builds on our notion of inventory, and it is very language focused. But I've been thinking about writers like Stephen King always saying, the adverb isn't your friend. It's a very common and I think very shallow bit of
Yeah,
advice.
it is.
But I think here's a brainstorm idea for when people are, I don't know, maybe having a break, maybe they're having a coffee or the old smoke break, or it's something to do when you are in between things and you can just add to it. Because I think there is a finite point to it. You exhaust these ideas, but you do learn a lot. And you learn a lot about not only patterns of language, but your own particular patterns of language and perception. Imagine this. Just every once in a while, write down as many different ways that you can think of to describe types of laughter, the ways in which someone can laugh, menacingly, stupidly, on and on and on. And I think laughter is a really good word, verb form, human activity to focus on. Because, I mean, you'd really think, wait a minute, laughter's, kind of always good. That what might be what some people would say first up, and then quickly they'd go, oh, no, that's not true. But the absolute varieties of emotionality, psychological tone and intent, situation, that laughter can be presented as, or as how that might be modified and further described. That is a really, really interesting exercise. Just to even stick with it for just one brainstorm session, you get a little bit more insight into a lot of your own thinking about many other major human activities.
I like that. That might be my bell work for tomorrow. Describe the different types of laughter. In terms of dreaming, so I've been in a bit of a funk, a sludge lately because of a dream I had recently,
Well, tell us.
in which I, it was Rios and I, Gus was not in the dream. And I don't know if this was taking place in the past, hopefully not the future, but it was a dream that, in just, as emotionally graphic, if not, image graphic wise, a slow disconnection from Rios, right? She was slowly falling out of love with me, and I was still in love with her. And I had to sort of watch as throughout this dream, no matter what I did, she was disinterested and was kind of moving on to other things. So I woke up in a greater panic, I think, than any nightmare that I've ever had. But I think that, I can connect it to the real world, not in terms of us growing apart in any way, but in, some potential new, career opportunities that would have me away for a bit, but that might be necessary in order to make more money, in order to send Gus to good schools and take care of my mom and things like that. So I do think that its roots came from anxiety in that respect. But it was interesting to me the different types of flavors of dreams that you can have where I feel like I went through it already, and what I'm hoping is that was the universe's way of putting me through something so that I don't actually have to go through it. You see what I mean?
I
Like
do. I do.
having the experience all at once so that I don't have to go through it over the course of several painful years while I might not be around as much as I would like to be. But yeah, very painful, very painful. It's still affecting me 4 days later. Which dreams can do on occasion.
Oh, they absolutely can. And I think this is a good example of the profound distinction between our dreaming lives, and the kind of dream that you've just described is only one aspect of that. But I think if you compare that to any possible aspect of media world, media land, the secondary, world of the matrix, the representational optical illusion of media and social media, nothing has that possible sort of impact. Nothing. And I think what you said really resonates with me, because at about your age, I really noticed a significant transition in the dreaming. And the expression that I use, there's a lot of thinking about this in the psychological literature, but I call it thresholding. And it was a real movement to, adulthood in a social responsible sort of way, and therefore the anxieties and the potential for nightmarish impact shifted. And oftentimes, very much in my experience, very much along the lines of what you're talking about, not something surrealistic or dramatic or in any way distanced from me in a way that was stylized. You know, the very impact of those kinds of dreams for me, looking back in time, that's when they started at about your age, and I still have variations on those. I think that's a way of adultness shaping us. And there is, I think, some kind of rehearsal, preparation, training, management sense going on there. I think we probably couldn't find the right word framework really for it. But I like the way you describe it, and I understand exactly what you mean.
I love that idea of it being a kind of rehearsal, because this sort of path that I'm going to go on, I will be away from them more than I'd like. I've been
Which
very
path
spoiled.
is this something that we've talked about, or I don't
No,
know?
this is relatively new. There's a friend of mine who's made a lot of money in real estate. And he's transitioning from purchasing real estate to purchasing businesses. And he and I have been talking for the past couple weeks now about putting me in charge of one of those businesses. So it's a massive leap in salary. It's a completely different set of skills from teaching. But there are practical concerns that I have right now, the rising costs of things. My stepfather is retiring from his job, which will halve my mother's, yearly income, essentially, because he's moving straight to Social Security, and it's not, they're going to be losing something on the order of $2,000 to $3,000 a month. And I would really like to be able to be a man who is able to take care of his mother if she needs the help. I want Gus has already, since my mother's job is to kind of test kids and see where they're at. He's a 3-year-old boy who is operating largely, not socially, but intellectually at a first grade level already. So he's incredibly advanced. And I'd like to be able to find him the proper schooling to, cultivate that. From what I've seen from my time at public school, I would be doing him a disservice by that. And thirdly, I want to be able to, sort of have the money to put out books that are actually seen by people that have an advertising budget, because I potentially might have the disposable income to do this. And so, and it's also very exciting. It's kind of a new, my astrological chart says that I'm going to be jumping. I jump around careers a lot. That's just sort of who I am. And so it really it's a frightening opportunity, but I'm not going to be scared out of it. Frightening in the sense that it's a lot of responsibility, basically. It's more
When did you
responsibility
start relative to the school year?
after it. So over the summer.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
And this is as good a place to talk about it as any, but my not full year, but almost a complete year of teaching, I was overwhelmed with a sense of not really understanding what I was doing teaching these kids, because of the phones and because of the fact that most of them shouldn't be there. They shouldn't be in class. It was probably, I held out for a really long time, but it was probably the 50th or 60th time that I brought something that I thought was really interesting and got the response of a bunch of kids staring down at their phones, where I thought, I don't really know if this is for me.
No, I really get you, and I am certain that thousands of teachers would understand what you're saying. And I think that the question is, what possibility of escape do you have? And I think that if people did have, a good job opportunity like what you described, that there would, I mean, there's a mass exodus from the profession even without those options. People have just had enough. So no, well, congratulations, David. I think you've stuck it out well. I'm not surprised. I think it is a loss, obviously, to your school, to the community. I think that this is part of an ongoing crisis that is bigger than, of course, than any one person or school district or even state. But no, I get it. I really do get it. You brought so much enthusiasm in. I think probably in a sense, the Jurassic Park response kind of seemed to really hit
That
home.
was the nail in the coffin. I
Yeah.
believe I told you when I started the book that if I can't get them interested in Jurassic Park, then I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that was just a total, it was incredible to me. Incredible to me how you could be uninterested and you would rather watch 15-second videos of morons lighting themselves on fire than read Jurassic Park. It definitely had. That was the. And you know what the funniest part is? Is that I got my evaluation recently. And this has been stewing for a couple, well, I guess my buddy brought this up to me close to a month ago. And we've ironed out the details, in fact, just before this call. And I didn't stop caring, but it was hard for me every day to not bring a little bit of bitterness and a little bit of like whatever. I mean, just do it. And my evaluation this time has doubled in effectiveness from when I started as a teacher.
Yeah.
The administrator. I started off with threes and twos, and this one was fours and fives. I don't know what that says, really, but
Well, I guess I do.
I
But
think you do. I think you
yeah,
do.
I do. And I think that I really just I empathize. I really do. I see this as being such a bigger issue. And I think it'll be interesting to come back because you're on spring break next week, and you've kind of easing into this new role that is out there on the horizon. It sounds like that's kind of stitched up and ready and waiting for you. So maybe in the next, few days, next week, some things will settle a little bit, and we can kind of return to this public education versus tourism, that model, and explore that with, maybe free from bitterness and
I,
a little
yeah.
bit more neutrality. I think
Yeah.
neutrality is really the crucial issue.
Neutrality is key, and I want to make it clear to listeners that I genuinely enjoy teaching. Something that I've gotten back on all of my evaluations, and I credit this podcast as being no small part of that, is my ease with which I talk to the kids and the clarity with which I deliver information. I like that. But they got to meet me halfway. I can be as clear as I possibly can, and I can have as much enthusiasm for it as I want, but I will never be as entertaining as a woman with big tits on TikTok. I know which one I would choose to look at if given the choice. So I really do think, well, I won't get too into it, but I think that next time that we talk, I'll just leave this. I do want to hear about your dreams, but I'll leave this with the thought that without, if we don't do something about those phones in school soon, doomed is not a dire enough word
I
for what's going
agree
to
with
happen.
that. I agree with that, David. I really, and I think that we need to raise our voices in real unison and harmony on this, because there is an enormously disharmonic, dark future ahead without some amazing turnaround on this front. I don't think any of the dire predictions can be exaggerated enough. So I'm with you
No.
on that. And we'll
Yeah.
keep sounding that alarm. Twisting the donkey, as a friend of mine used to say, it wasn't enough to ring the bell or sound the gong. You had to, really make
Yeah,
sure it's
twist the
vocal.
donkeys. Yeah, absolutely. What about your dream life? How's that been going?
Well, did you get I sent you some music that I thought we might
I
go out.
did.
Yeah,
Yeah, yeah,
I think
yeah.
that's kind of where what's happened to me since I think I got to spring break. I mean, I really, really understand exactly what you're talking about. I think I've been deeply, deeply depressed. I think I've been really, really exhausted trying to keep pace with the demands of very, very different student groups and really wanting to focus on my own projects, this podcast, real creative, fun things, even if it's really hard work, because there's hard work in every project, as everyone knows, to certainly to bring it to fruition. So I was somewhat surprised because I had some very troubled sleeping and a lot of really vivid dreaming. I think I shared a bunch. I had one of my strange tropes is on the nightmarish end of the spectrum is these kind of very disturbed, creepy, sometimes deformed rural people, oftentimes drawing on some of the darker moments in Australia. More that than here. But then in the last few nights, I've been absolutely, I haven't moved. I haven't gotten up to pee. I haven't had any water. I've just been crashed. And the only thing I remember from last night's dream was someone, and I'm not sure who, it might have been Lisa, but somebody unexpected. And I think that's a polite way of saying not really able to sing, was singing rather too exuberantly that old Mamas and the Papas song, California Dreaming. And that was the only take at. But meanwhile, the music piece that I sent you is something that the ensemble and I did at the Nevada Percussion Lab. And we got a really good response to it. And it kind of was doing a lot of my dreaming for me. And I think that's something that happens that for me, the richer my actual creative production is during a day, oftentimes the sounder I'll have slept and maybe I won't necessarily pull away much dream activity. It's not always, it's not an easy formula. It's not exact, but I felt very charged with this percussion. I thought it was getting a lot of what of the chaos of dreaming is about, but also sort of some of the repeating structures, the motifs that underlie it. So I thought that might be the way to end this show. But this was really interesting, and I loved your we're going to call it Clipspringer now. I think that's a wonderful new take on Gatsby. And I think you should really consider that and just maybe drop a note to Bret Easton Ellis and say, look, there's a cameo for you if it ever goes to the movies. He might get really excited about that and go, yeah, let's make it happen.
That would be cool. That would be awesome. All right, everybody, enjoy this piece from Chris, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, everyone. It's called Recurring Dreams. Be well. See you next week.